Ready or not. Here we go. Kind of on the line that we were talking about, 135, first paragraph, from the end of the first paragraph, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines. We are obviously living in a time.
I'm sorry, which page?
113. First paragraph, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We are obviously living in a time resembling that of the beginning of the decline of ancient culture and the origins of Christianity. A time of extreme inner and outer crisis, a time that presses toward a deep-reaching change. She returns to this idea of demons as compulsive sexuality, of pride, probably what we would call narcissism today, or hubris, Greek word for pride, power. Now, she starts a slightly different theme on the bottom of 114.
114.
What's it mean to integrate these things? Well, sometimes you can integrate them, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to run away from them, that we've already talked about. But this idea she introduces now is a shift. Go to the bottom of 114, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. If we accept the interpretation widely held today of the word religio as a conscientious consideration of the numinous, then the demons simply want basically to be religiously taken into account by human beings. If some of these can be integrated, by that I mean what they represent can be turned into a different way of thinking, a different way of feeling, a different way of acting. In other words, that you will change and your new lifestyle will include what these figures represent. Sometimes you can't integrate them, and what you do is serve them. That's what I understand by taking into account. What does that demon want me to do in my daily life?
Is it serving them in a way, integrating?
Well, I think the difference is when you integrate them, you stop dreaming of them. And when you're serving them, you will continue to dream of them, but they might become a little less threatening. But they'll always be there challenging you to make a new change at different points. I think this is kind of parallel to the way Jung put it, that the shadow can be integrated, but the anima and animus cannot be integrated. In other words, let's suppose you're a polite Christian who projects evil onto others. I mean, I just heard, I can believe this, I was talking to a woman whose brother is a fundamentalist. And she is renting a room in a house where the owner of the house is a male. And the brother accuses her of living in sin. See what I mean? if that brother, let's say, could own up to his own sexuality and live it, then he wouldn't project it onto her. And that whole arrangement of blaming and shame and guilt would just evaporate. But I think there are other, and so he would stop dreaming of whatever is in his dreams about that issue. But I think there are other demons, or really daimons, that don't ever stop showing up in our dreams. And they show up from time to time whenever we need to make a change. So what they're doing is guiding us, really, and showing us, here's where life should go. Old Cecil Aerist gives her a chance. This is the bottom of 115. See if there's anything else we want to talk about. I don't think so. Well, she just, the top of 115, she gets into the same thing, how lust and so on are daimons. The question she gets into, which again surprised me a little when I read her conclusion, is if we are unconscious of these things, are we guilty of transgressions when we act unconsciously? Because if her brother had any idea that there was an alternative to his point of view, then we could talk about him being guilty of harming her. And it really is harming her. Von Franz would say, no, he's not guilty. If you are acting unconsciously, you are not guilty. And she's referring to this other woman, I don't know, Cecil Ernst, who says, oh yes, you are guilty, whether you're conscious of it or not. I don't like either of those alternatives. I think there's a third. I was a little surprised she talked like this.
Where is that on 115?
115, yeah. Cecil, well, it starts there. Cecil Ernst does not believe in devils and demons. She stresses especially the strong cravings for recognition that psychically ill persons have. She stresses especially the strong cravings for recognition that psychically ill persons have and interprets their statements as hysterical confabulations they use in order to attract the attention of those around them. The extravagant theatrical display of exorcistic rites has a positive effect only because it panders to this hysterical need of the patient for attention and recognition. Now that's what old Dr. Ernst says. Let's skip down. I got a little bit ahead of myself. Let's skip down to the last paragraph, and then we'll go the last couple sentences on that section, and then we'll go back to earlier in the paragraph. The ego is responsible only to a certain extent for the effect a person has on his environment. namely for what Jung calls the personal shadow of the individual, but not for archetypal psychic factors. Ignoring one's shadow, though, is often very much like opening a door through which these powers can break in. The question of moral responsibility is therefore extremely subtle and requires different judgments from case to case. But basically, her point is, if you're unconscious of something, you're not guilty if you make a mistake. If you're conscious and you make a mistake, you're guilty. But that excuses the whole Nazi.
Also, it penalizes you for being conscious, which is,
yeah, I know.
Like, I mean, that doesn't make sense to me. The Buddhists have it very different.
Go ahead.
As long as you have some level of awareness, then basically you're not guilty. Like that, that to the degree you're conscious of something, you're forgiven for your errors. So it's exactly the opposite.
Just the opposite.
Yes,
wow.
that you're responsible and you're held guilty for what you were completely unconscious of. So there's a motive to become conscious.
Yeah.
Because even if you see the wrong you're doing and you can't stop yourself, it's a far more forgivable thing than to be completely oblivious. Which makes it don't even make any sense to me. I mean, how can you be penalized for trying to wake the fuck up? I mean, we're never going to get it right, so we're going to have to muddle around. But, I mean, so at least that makes sense to me when I read the Buddhist philosophy.
And the other thing is, whether you're guilty or not, the evil still happens. If you are unconscious and you allow a huge amount of unconscious, evil, destructive energy through you, conduits, say, like Hitler did, the destruction still happens. At what point was he, you know, that's the old, well, my client was under the influence of drugs when he murdered 5 people.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't realize what he was doing. But he knew he took the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at what point, you know, the guilty piece was the first time he took the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the, maybe it's not, but he still did it.
Literally, I was called in. They called me up for jury duty. And it was exactly that situation, except in the opposite. He didn't take his
drug,
and he killed somebody. Mm-hmm. Killed 3 people, I think.
Wow.
And they were pleading, you know, and I read of this by insanity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a psychopath, and maybe it's a little more difficult. But here's where I would go. And I think it's kind of where Jung went. And I'm just a little surprised at what she said here, that if you do something out of an affect where you're not in control, in other words, you're unconscious, you're not guilty. But you have a responsibility to go back and find out what complex caused that behavior. Does that make sense? If you blow up at somebody, don't beat yourself up. But do ask yourself, what part of me is coming to meet me in that event that I don't have a relationship to? There's no right or wrong here, but that's how I work with it. What bothers me a little bit in my profession, you'll hear people say, well, he fell into a complex and he did such and such. Okay, so what? And that is used to excuse the behavior. Don't.
Like, not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah, a little moment of insanity.
Yeah.
And that is a mis. As I read it, that's a kind of where she is here a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that was Jung's final position. And his was more, okay. You fell into your complex. Now you're responsible. You're not guilty for that act,
mm-hmm.
but you are responsible for finding out why you did that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that much more.
Yeah, and that's completely consistent with the Buddhist philosophy, that you're responsible and something you're not responsible
for. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's the way they have it too. That, I mean, we have to see what it is that we're doing, you know, so that there's no way we're not going to, you know, make errors, you know, and the only way we're going to find out is by then going back and looking at them. You know, and if we hang ourselves for what we've done, no consciousness is really gained by
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
So it would be the difference between the shaming parent that says to the little child who didn't understand what they did, you are a terrible person, versus the good parent who says, I understand you're upset, but you can't poke your sister's eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And would there be another way to deal with right. that feeling?
How else can you? Yeah. How can we work with
that? I'll poke her in her stomach.
Where you can't see the mark.
It reminds me of a little cold boy stuff in my head because it was so kind of horrendous when I was a teenager doing some research in the form where it was about humor, bad humor or something. Willie hung his little sister. She was dead before they missed him. Willie saw himself to tricks. Ain't he cute? He's only six. there's just something macabre.
Yeah.
In a first grade classroom, there was a kid with a parole officer. I'm like, well, the child is not the problem here. I mean, you know, that's an environment you have to fix. Give the kid a parole officer, it's not going to fix it.
Wow.
Well, if the setup is the angels set it up that we would, the giants,
yeah.
The earth would become this hothouse. I mean, it would be an experimentation. It would be where we make mistakes. It would be where we rage overcomes us or
right.
lust over whatever it is.
Right.
Then, I mean, this all makes sense. And, you know, it is via our mistakes that we can become more conscious.
Right.
Yeah.
And then proceed to hopefully a better world if we don't destroy it first.
Yeah, and that those moments are the way in which you can get to know what's inside you. I think that's the deeper point.
So using guilt for a purpose. I
mean, yeah.
Feeling guilty.
Yeah.
That, you know, we learn to actually, you know, grow and become conscious and, you know, get something out of the experience, not, you know, to be punitive, which I think is the way we have it.
I think, you know, there's a sort of a pop psych view that, oh, you should never let people get to you. You should always, you know, don't let them affect your feelings. And Jung's position is, yeah, let them affect your feelings. Go ahead. I mean, he's not advising you to go around blowing up at people. But if you do get rattled, don't be ashamed of it. Turn to yourself. It's not a failure. It's a chance to get to know another side of yourself that's coming to meet you. And that's how I prefer that to what she said here.
There's a wonderful Rumi poem where he talks about that. You know, this being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, a momentary awareness arrives as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all.
Mm.
Even if it's a crowd of sorrows who violently empty your house of its furniture, still, meet each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in, for each has been sent as a guide from beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're going to W.R. Poet Laureate here.
Poem for every occasion.
That's beautiful. And that's exact. If one can attain that, mm-hmm. that is an enormous level of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to... And so that a high level of consciousness can permit itself unconsciousness and spontaneity and then follow up on it and not destroy oneself with guilt if possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So that was the bit about guilt. Another really, I thought, brilliant couple of sentences are on top of 116, the fourth line down. You know, we are, at least in my position, one's constantly bombarded with other psychological points of view, namely the Freudians. Who are on this narcissism kick. And here I think she has put Jung's alternative to their saying that the narcissist is somebody with a wounded ego who needs to aggrandize as a defense against feelings of inferiority. I think that's the basic Freudian theory these days. I've never been able to swallow it completely. And what she says is so simple, and I think, why didn't I think of that? Well, it's because she's a genius and I'm not. But here's what she says, which I think is very helpful. Now, she's going back to Dr. Aaron, so I kind of jumped around a little bit, who's saying,
where are you?
Top of 116, who's saying in kind of earlier language what the Freudians are now calling narcissistic theory, that people need attention because there's something wrong with them. I'm putting it a little simply, but that's the basic argument. You know, you have a defective development, you didn't get the attention in childhood, so you go around seeking it, and that's an indication of infantile attitude. But what she says is, go down to the fourth line, we have seen that demons are often regarded as desiring ceremonial honors. When a person who is psychically ill wishes to attract the interest of other people to himself, this desire, in my opinion, belongs more to the complex and not always so much to the patient's ego. I love that. It's so simple. But So what we're calling narcissists are people who have complexes that are trying to express themselves, and because the person, for whatever reason, isn't taking that complex seriously, that complex is demanding attention. So what we have to do is understand what in them is seeking honor. And it will be something like a talent or an interest or a skill. So I think, you know, she's really come up with two very simple but very powerful ideas. For me, anyway. One, we project onto science just like we project onto religion. That's a new idea. I never thought of it before. Damn it, how do you get these ideas? And that what we're calling narcissism is the desire of our daimons for ceremonial honors. And how does a narcissist act? Like a prince or a princess. And it's their unconscious seeking meaning that's behind it.
And the more they run from that, from facing that complex, the stronger it gets.
I think. And then
until it becomes demonic. Until
it becomes Bernie Madoff. Yeah. Okay.
So the answer is really creativity,
which she said a couple things. Yeah. And to see what the Freudian stuff does, it works with the ego in trying to overcome this. And what she's saying is more along Jung's lines here, it's of course consistent. No, you work with the unacknowledged unconscious content. And it's the nature of unconscious contents to attract attention.
And can you do that in someone who doesn't have a well-developed ego?
Probably not.
Okay. I'm just thinking of some of the kids that my daughter is working
with. Oh, God, no. Now, first of all, we're talking about adults. But I think, you know, it's easy for me to say, but if... if the parent can, or the educator can listen to what that child's natural inclinations are, that's the way to get this under control.
But also, children can be a channel for the demonic in their environment. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that's what you're dealing with.
Yeah, it could be the parents' unlived talent. But then I think often the parents' unlived talent and their talent are the same. The child's talent are the same.
I can see, like, I can see how you would look at the demonic that is your own narcissism, and you would say, what in me is needing attention? But I was reading Shadow and Evil and Fairy Tales, and she talked about she had a client, well, her first client, and she couldn't break through with this woman, so the woman had gone to see Jung one time, and Jung said, just drop her out of there, because you're just feeding the demon. And I thought, how do you, when you're dealing with people, how do you feed the good in them and not
TV, the demon? Well, you're only telling half the story. Remember the second part of the story?
No, I don't. She got better.
I don't know if she did or not, but he didn't charge her for the hour.
Right.
And he was nice to her.
Right.
And then she went off and badmouthed him to everybody around town. And he said, watch when you give somebody energy what they do with it. And I think that is the key. That's the difference between a codependent and a healthy giver. A codependent will keep on giving even when, or maybe even because that energy is misused. Where a giver will say, well, you obviously don't want what I have to give. I'll give it to somebody else. So To heal from this really means moving into a little bit more loneliness. There are fewer people you can talk to. And to realize that person I can give to and that person I cannot give to. But get ready for feedback, because it will not be appreciated. I think we have to, most of us are in the helping profession one way or another, and we do want to care for the world, but be very careful about how you care. That's something I certainly have learned.
And just to make it more on the whole issue of guilt.
Yeah.
I took her to mean that the person is guilty with their shadow, stuff they do with their shadow.
Yes.
But with the archetypal invasions, that it's harder to get them conscious about that.
Yes.
And so it's conditional as to when they are guilty or not guilty.
I think we're saying the same thing or similar things.
Okay.
In other words, that the archetypal invasion would be more what would come over you. And the shadow would be more what you can control. So, I still disagree with her that, in other words, because Hitler was overcome with greed, then he's not responsible. See what I'm saying? It just doesn't sit right.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, so these are kind of extremes, you know. But
yeah.
I mean, I'm just talking about a simple idiot like me running around, you know, that it would be, because my shadow would be more scaled down.
Yeah.
Much more scaled down than if an archetypal factor took me over. So I can see what she's saying is degrees, it's conditional. I mean, but I understand what you're saying. I mean, you know, I don't think she would, maybe she just didn't come out and say that about going back and becoming more conscious.
Right.
Maybe she just didn't say that, but I would think she would agree with that. But I just think her distinction here is between the shadow stuff.
Yeah, personal and collective.
I wonder what her target audience and what the... I think that my sense is maybe that's taken... If you put it in the context of today and the things we're discussing,
yeah,
she would say something different. But that she was driving home a point about a particular time frame.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Certainly it makes sense to the Christian who judges everything. Maybe that's what she's aiming at.
I think of, like, you know, it's easy in the scenario I said earlier, it's easy for me to make a judgment about the person that used drugs and killed somebody, but the difficulty we have is we don't see where we're projecting our own shadow, and we don't know the circumstances, so we have to be very cautious, I think, in how we're judging other people. But we have to, but yeah, we have to cautiously know that we may not know all the circumstances. Maybe that's where she's, I don't know, saying that unconsciously.
Well, part of the problem is our judgment can be our projection of our evil into another person.
Right.
So that's the problem with, like, holding someone responsible versus the judgment we have. And I think that you have to differentiate, you know, again, making somebody the scapegoat and blaming them and all the things we do in criminal court versus holding someone responsible for their behavior at, you know, whatever level they could possibly be responsible. You know, I guess it depends on how crazy they are, but I think that's the problem about judgment.
Let me try see if this is an answer, sort of backdoor answer, that with the personal shadow and with things that are within my purview, when I lapse into a behavior or an emotion, I would say to myself, now why did I do that? I would make a moral effort to understand that particular behavior. Where if it's a collective or if I'm overcome with something, I would be more likely to say, what part of me is coming to me in this way? What part of me is coming to me in this way?
And what would the first question be?
Why did I do that? How am I going to not do that again? Oh, darn it, I did it again. How was I not paying attention? Where the latter sees that, where I would see in the latter case, it's an invitation to serve another part of myself. Invitation, I mean it, but I also say that ironically because it doesn't feel like an invitation. But it's that we have two different attitudes towards ourselves. When do we hold ourselves responsible for guilt, and when do we say, that's the wrong question. Something is being asked of me from this part that comes to me, not only from that emotion that I might have fallen into or behavior. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. One is ego-centered, the other is an ego-focused question, the other is a self-focused question. Knowing that probably for everything I say there is an exception, but just trying to... I just see a fair amount of people have done things like, you know, what's that? Mirror, Course on Mirror things. Where everything is like willpower, 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 willpower. Don't, you know, you felt that, change that. You can control your life. And Jung is saying, no, you can't. And acknowledge where you can't control your life, or you're not controlling your life, but then open an inquiry as to the meaning of that lapse. I think that's where it comes down to practice. I mean, I've even had people say to me in workshops and stuff, well, you know, that's just irresponsible. You are, if you let somebody provoke you, then you've lost control. The healthy person doesn't let anyone affect them. And if you are affected, it's your problem. And I have to say, no, that's exactly not Jung's position. I'm sorry. That might work for the shadow. But we don't see the good life as never losing control. But once you do, then you have to start asking questions. Not so much about that event as the part of yourself that wants to be known through that event.
I mean, that sort of standpoint sort of erases your moral responsibility of taking action in the environment. Oh, he's not supposed to let anything bother.
Exactly.
It's an easy out. It's like, okay, I'm just responsible for myself, meaning that you don't have a responsibility for other things in the world, it's a cop out.
Yeah, it's a big cop out.
And it's kind of a comfortable thing, like, oh, I'll just focus on my own reactions and try to eliminate them, however unsuccessful that may be. But I think.
I remember in the New York dream, that person needed high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. You need to be upset sometimes.
That's where I think Jung, I mean, he says those emotions are where we really learn from.
Yeah, that's another way to put it.
And most of the time we're trying to put it off by denying it or repressing it or dismissing it, which those power-driven things do.
Mm-hmm.
Workshops on how to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And that's what calls it. But for those of us, I mean, for us who acknowledge, not only acknowledges, but want to learn from them, that's...
That's a great way to put it. Some experiences are there so we learn from them. And others are there so other mistakes shouldn't be looked at that way. We have learned, we're just not paying attention. Yeah. But it's helped me I shouldn't have said that, but I did say it now. What's the purpose of this moment? I think we've done a lot of this last part of the chapter already. She talks about gods and demons, 117 at the top. We already did that. She talks about the Christian negativizing daimons, the middle of 117. We already did that. She returns to the business. It's only in the field of ego consciousness, the bottom of 117. A human being is fully responsible for everything he does. We have critiqued that. Then back to the question of what's it mean to become conscious of daimons, and that's on 118. Active imagination is one of Jung's ways of dealing with them. I think to integrate them would mean to make the behavior change that they're oppressing. That's more typical of the shadow. And then that dream image will disappear. Those others that won't disappear, that keep coming back in dreams, we have to then ask them why they keep coming back. And the point is that they have probably a presence in us which isn't going to go away, and they want us to do certain things in the world so that this negative experience is meant to show us a voice capable of guiding us. And how you get to that? By talking to them. Ask them, what do you want? What do you want of me? Why are you here? And there, I'm just thinking of this. Remember, Hugh Grant got busted for having sex with a prostitute in a car, something like that. And if you listen to these guys, I guess the women too, they always said, "Oh, it was a mistake. I bad judgment. I'm going to do better." And you'll never hear them say, "What part of me was leading me into that, and how can I recognize the validity of that part and not give in to the behavior?" That would be the act of imagination. Why did you set me up to do that? I'm living with a beautiful woman. Why am I having sex with a hooker in the backseat of a car? Something is trying to be communicated, and the moral reaction, maybe this is why Bon Francis says what she says earlier, the moral reaction completely cuts that out. It's wrong. So what? If you don't recognize that that behavior was there to teach you something, it will come back. So that's how active imagination, what I would call serving the daimon, fit together. And as she says, she thinks Jung is one of the few schools that, or maybe the only school that, honors the daimon. Top of 119. Except for evil. Look down there near the bottom of 119, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. If, writes Jung, this paramount power of evil is imputed to the soul, the result can only be a negative inflation, that is a daimonic claim to power on the part of the unconscious, which makes it all the more formidable. So that we can't talk with. Behind that is the God image. Behind that is that's the dark side of the God image. As I said, I have seen very little of that. And the clearest one is the dream we talked about a bit through the Russian, where what you have to do is in the dream, this guy is approached by a man named Victor the Russian who wants him to take a potion. And that's how Victor the Russian, who's evil, reincarnates himself every couple of generations. And the dreamer refuses it. But as a result of the refusal, turns into Victor the Russian anyway. And a colleague sent me that dream. It's not nobody I've worked with, but we talked about it. I've since met the dreamer. What I felt was you have to take his poison but not drink it. That's how you do it.
Like you can hold it.
You have to acknowledge this is evil, but you can't take personal responsibility for it. Mm-hmm. So if you drink it, you say, "I'm guilty." Mm-hmm. If you refuse it, you say, "It never happened." Mm-hmm. If you take it but don't drink it, which is what the dreamer did not do, you say, "This is evil, but I'm not taking responsibility for it."
You can't say what the person was like?
What was the person like?
Yeah.
Actually, he was a theology professor.
Of course, he would refuse it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a typical theology.
But that dream occurred many years before he worked with my colleague. What he did after working with my colleague, he quit his Ivy League professor of theology and bought a sheep farm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. Well, we're almost done. Let's just get this chapter done. Well, maybe we shouldn't try to rush through it.
Yeah.
Because we're still, what she does on the top of 120 is she talks about evil, which we probably should talk about. Then she talks about rancorous speech. And then she sums up. So we're almost done. Let's say we got to the top of 120. And we're doing better, I think, huh? How much do we get done today?
I don't think it's a question of speed.
Well, I just don't want to be sitting here when we're all at Marquette Manor, that's all.
Why not? What else would you have better to do at Marquette Manor?
Okay, all right. Okay, I stand corrected.
I don't know how to knit, so we're going to have to do something.
You'd be lucky enough.
I'm just trying to figure out how much to have you read next time. Maybe... Why don't you read all of chapter 6? We won't get through it, but you'll have it under your belt. We'll probably get through, I guess, what, 20 pages? We'll probably get through 10 pages of it.
Do we want to bring Holiday?
Holiday Cheer?
Yes.
It's our last class before Christmas?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. Sorry, I was thinking about beforehand and I forgot.
Fine with me.
The little bunch here.
Yeah. The John, your wife doesn't have to cook.
Yeah.
You can just bring something simple.
Yeah. Someone else is going to have to make it if I bring it, because I'm not a cook, so that's fine. But Whole Foods is good.
Yeah.
Slave or the deli counter, Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. We'll have a little party.